Our first case for argument this morning is Rogers Cartage against Monsanto. Mr. Schultz.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rob Schultz for the appellant, Rogers Cartage Company. We were the plaintiff in a third-party complaint down below. It's a Superfund case involving PCBs. Rogers was sued by Conoco and then for cleaning up the Conoco site. And then Rogers filed a third-party complaint against Monsanto Solutia Pharmacia, the source of the PCBs. And then the district court dismissed our third-party complaint based on a motion by the Solutia defendants that the claim had been released. The written settlement agreement, that's the basis of that motion, was not part of the petition, but talks only about releasing Area 1 and Area 2 claims. The Conoco facility is not part of Area 1. It's not part of Area 2.
How do we know that?
Well, you
assert that several times.
Yes, sir.
Area 1 and Area 2 have precise definitions.
Yes, sir.
In the document. And so I looked in your brief to see where you discuss those definitions, and you don't.
Well, two things. With regard to the physical point of whether Conoco is within Area 1 or Area 2, that would, of course, be the burden of the defendants in this case, if they want to say the release applies.
It's not simply the burden of the defendants. The district court found that it does. You have to persuade us that the district court is wrong. And so, naturally, one would think you need to compare what Conoco's claim is with the actual definition in the settlement agreement.
Correct.
And as I say, your brief doesn't even mention the definition in the settlement agreement.
Well,
so how can we possibly conclude the district court got this wrong?
Actually, in part of the brief, we talk about whether the definition of Area 1 includes the Conoco facility, and that is apparently two parts. One is, could the Conoco claim, was that part of the old litigation? The answer is no. And then number two is the Conoco facility somehow a ditch leading to Area 1? And the answer to that is no. And there's simply no evidence to support those two assertions brought by the Solutia defendants. And with regard to the... Yes, sir.
Correct that you do not discuss the definition anywhere in your brief?
No, sir. I believe we do discuss the definition.
Where?
Okay.
Tell me where I should look.
Paragraph 17 of our brief, we talk about Section 5 of the settlement agreement.
Excuse me?
Page
the brief doesn't have paragraph numbers in it.
Excuse me, Judge. Page 17 of our initial brief, we discuss the various sections of the settlement agreement where the releases occur. And that's where we discuss the language of it, where we talk about Section 5A1 is the first release.
I am totally lost. The definition of the areas is in Section 3B, 7 and 8 of the settlement agreement.
Correct, Your Honor.
And mentioning Section 5A of the settlement agreement does not discuss the definition of these areas. That's what this case is about.
Yes,
is there someplace where you discuss Conoco's claims in relation to the definition in Section 3B7 and 3B8 of
yes,
the settlement
sir.
Agreement?
Yes, sir. The sections of the settlement agreement are Section 2B7. That is the definition of Area 1. And, of course, it starts out by saying it's the part of Area 1 shown on a map. And, of course, the Conoco facility is not part of that. I don't think there's any allegation that it's contiguous to. And then we talk about the part about how there's no proof that it's a ditch
I take it then the answer is no. You can't point me to any place in your brief discussing the actual definition in the settlement agreement of the covered areas.
No, sir. Hang on one moment. I believe it's page 17 of my brief, where I talk about in relationship to the releases themselves. I go through each one of the releases and talk about how it does not apply in this case. And then I also talk...
17 is what you pointed us to. It talks about Section 5 of the settlement.
Right. And then...
Look, why don't you go on with your argument?
Sure.
I did a search, right? We've got these briefs in Acrobat format. It's just not there.
I was curious. I just had a jurisdictional question. You dismissed your cross claims against MS&P in the Saget case without prejudice.
Yes, ma'am.
So, do we have a final judgment?
Those cross claims were dismissed around, I'm going to say 2010, 2011. Yes, ma'am. They were dismissed, and then that case was.
And that was a dismissal without prejudice.
Yes, ma'am. And those cross claims are not at issue in this matter. This deals with a cross-claim initially filed in the Conoco lawsuit, which got severed and then sent back to the old Area 1 case.
So those cross-claims without prejudice can't be brought back?
They might be able to be brought back, but they have not been and won't be. We've settled with Monsanto Solution Pharmacia for Area 1 and Area 2 matters, and those cross-claims that you're mentioning were Area 1 cross-claims. So we released them, and they were dismissed without prejudice later on.
I have a different jurisdictional question, which is how one can appeal in the 2011 case, the part that was severed and sent to a second district judge, when there hasn't been a judgment in that case.
Well,
district court said that he was going to dismiss it. Right. The next step is a Rule 58 judgment.
Yes, sir.
The notice of appeal was filed before a Rule 58 judgment was entered. And under Rule 4A6, I believe, you have to wait 150 days for that to happen, and you didn't.
We actually filed two notices of appeal, Your Honor.
I'm aware of that.
Out of caution.
And one might say that the second notice of appeal would bring up the issue in the first, except that the second notice of appeal was filed in a different district court docket number, the 1999 case, because that's the case in which the sanctions were entered.
Yes, sir. I think the first one was filed in the 99 case, too. What happened was our third-party complaint in the Conoco case...
Then I'm completely puzzled. I don't see how the first one could be filed in the 1999 case, not only the fact that he wasn't part of the 1999 case, but the district court had said there were further issues to be resolved, so that would be non-final.
What happened, Judge, first, I believe it was filed in the 99 case. It was filed within a few days of the district court announcing that my third-party claim was dismissed.
Yes, but an announcement is not a judgment, and you can't appeal from an announcement.
Well...
Rule 4A6 says that if there's an announcement and no judgment for 150 days, then it's treated as if there were a judgment, and then you can appeal, but you can't appeal from an announcement.
Then the district court issued months later, the district court issued a written decision dismissing our third-party complaint, and we filed a notice of appeal from that too, and I believe both of those were in the 99 case.
How does the first notice of appeal come within federal appellate jurisdiction when there was no judgment? And if it was filed in the 1999 case, there was no final decision.
We thought that the docket entry announcing the dismissal...
The docket entry is not a judgment. Rule 4 couldn't be clearer.
Judge, I understand. We did it out of caution. And then later on, when the district court issued its order, written order, again announcing that our third-party complaint was dismissed, we filed a notice of appeal from that, too, to make sure. We didn't want to get caught up in a gray area of procedure and lose our right to appeal to this court.
Rule 4A6 couldn't be clearer. There is no possibility of losing a right to appeal if you act within 180 days of the announcement. That's what the rule is all about.
I understand. Anyway, Judge, as you point out, we filed two notices of appeal, and those appeals have been consolidated today because we wanted to make sure that we didn't get caught up in a, we didn't lose our rights through not filing a notice of appeal. So we filed two. As you say, one may have been enough. With regard to the discussion of the releases, aside from the text of the releases, which do not mention Conoco, Phillips, the Conoco property, initially the claim to clean up the Conoco property was brought by Conoco, and then Conoco changed its name to Phillips, so if I cut back and forth, I apologize. But the releases themselves talk about Area 1 and Area 2. Later on in the settlement agreement, there is a reference to the Conoco matter. It's not in a release. It's just, it talks about the Cahokia facility. And so the parties knew, the parties being Rogers Cartage and Monsanto Solution Pharmacia, knew about the possibility of a Conoco cleanup claim. And actually, there's a reference to it in the settlement agreement, but that reference, those words, nothing about Conoco appear in the releases. The Conoco claims were not released. Furthermore, under Illinois law, releases are strictly construed, and if you don't specifically list something, it's not released. And in this case, the agreement, the settlement agreement, specifically refers to Illinois law governing it. And under Illinois law, these releases don't do it. And then finally, in a strange quirk, my opposing counsel got deposed in a case, and in his deposition, this came up. And he several times he said the settlement agreement doesn't reach Conoco or the property or the distributor.
Hey, in that settlement agreement,
yes, sir.
You talk about the strict construction against, I guess, against the drafter. Is that
well? No, actually, it's different. It's against the scope of the release. What?
But there's a provision 11E that says the agreement was negotiated by the parties with the advice of counsel, and any ambiguities determined to exist in the agreement are not to be construed against any party.
Correct.
So doesn't that undo all of that Illinois law concept?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for two reasons. Number one is that's talking about the, I guess, the rule of construction that ambiguities are construed against the drafter, and I did not raise that because of that provision. Illinois law has something different, which is releases on the whole, no matter who drafts them, are construed against release. So if I had drafted this, which I did not, I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't mean to.
That's where the mic's
anyway. So no, Your Honor, because that's talking about the, I guess, the presumption against the drafter. And that's not a presumption I've raised because of that provision in the settlement agreement. So Illinois law goes on to say releases are construed against release. And in fact, if there's a claim that's not mentioned in a release specifically, then it's not released. That's simply a strong facet of Illinois law, which I pointed out. And then finally, as I was pointing out, in this case we have the strange situation where my opposing counsel was deposed. And I was, this had nothing to do with me, I was not there. And several times in that deposition, opposing counsel said that the settlement agreement doesn't deal with the Conoco property, and it doesn't deal with the Cahokia site. The Cahokia site is another way of talking about the Conoco property. It's located in Cahokia. So for those three reasons, the releases don't talk about Conoco or Phillips or the Cahokia site. Number two, Illinois law would say if you don't mention something in the releases specifically, then it's not released.
But there is mention of this Cahokia claims against Rogers.
Yes.
In paragraph 4F.
Correct. Yes. Later on in the settlement agreement, there's a reference. It's referred to as the
Cahokia
claims facility. Involving the Cahokia facility alleged to have been operated by Rogers. That's the Conoco site or the Phillips site, depending on the time period you're talking about it. And so in the settlement agreement, the parties mentioned it, but didn't put it in the releases. And the reason was it wasn't being released. And as you know, third-party defendants in a CERCLA claim, a release is not that is normally not that valuable a thing. Conoco could have sued Rogers and the Solution defendants, and the fact that there was a release between them, between the third part, the defendants, probably would have no effect on the ultimate distribution of costs. The only time it becomes important is if the Superfund plaintiff does not sue one of the defendants, which happened in this case. Only Rogers was sued, and because of that, that's why Solution Pharmacy and Monsanto had brought up a defense which the deposition of their own counsel would indicate does not apply. Now, one other thing is there are some portions of my initial brief which talked about the severance and the transfer of this third-party claim. I did not bring that up in a reply brief. I'm not going to argue it today because shortly before Christmas, Rogers Cartage settled with Conoco. Actually, it's Phillips at the time, and paid them about a third of what their cleanup costs were. $1.5 million was paid, and so the Conoco lawsuit, the Phillips lawsuit, is shortly going to be dismissed with prejudice. So I don't think there's anything, if the court was inclined, there won't be a Conoco case to send this one back to. So that's why I have not argued severance or something like that, because I'm getting straight to the merits. After the judge announced that the third party complaint was being dismissed because of release, a few days later, after that announcement, that's when Monsanto Solution Pharmacia filed their motion for sanctions. They said that the releases unambiguously released Conoco claims, even though those claims aren't mentioned, in spite of Illinois law, and in spite of the testimony of their own counsel. And the district court, several months later, hit my client with $200,000 in sanctions. Now, we might be able, I don't think there's much of an argument about this, but you might disagree about whether the releases could be construed to cover the Conoco property. I think we can all agree that they certainly don't seem to or don't expressly do that. And then number two is, while we might disagree about the effect of Illinois law, I don't think we should, but it might be possible, it's hard to look at the deposition testimony of my opponent and find that the releases or the settlement agreement reached the Conoco dispute. Now, before we filed these third-party complaints, we had the settlement agreement, we had Illinois law, and we had the deposition testimony of opposing counsel. I agree it's a strange situation. I've never had that before, where you have deposition testimony of your opposing counsel. Like I said, I was not involved in that. I wasn't there. The questions were not mine. But I think we can all agree that my client had a reasonable basis for bringing this third-party complaint, and that sanctions, when you've got that kind of support for what you're doing, were not appropriate. Now, aside from the fact that the dismissal based on a release was, as we contend, an error, I think also the fact that we had a reasonable basis for doing it. This isn't a situation where we repeatedly brought claims. I mean, we've all read the cases where sanctions have been given, and they normally involve some sort of obvious misuse of the judicial process without support. Not only do we have support, but the procedures that you're supposed to follow weren't followed here. There was no 21-day service of the motion for sanctions. There was no hearing on the motion for sanctions. No show cause order on the motion for sanctions. Practiced law 20-some years, and I've never had a client sanctioned. And to have them sanctioned here when the settlement agreement doesn't deal with the Conoco property, when my opposing counsel testified under oath it did, it's surprising enough to have that third-party claim dismissed under those circumstances, but then to be sanctioned for it is a pretty ugly thing to have happen. So, based on the words of the settlement agreement, based on Illinois' law, which the settlement agreement says applies, that releases are construed against release, and if you don't specifically list a dispute in the release, then it's not released. And then, based on opposing counsel's deposition testimony that the settlement agreement did not deal with the Conoco property, I respectfully ask the court to reverse the dismissal of the third-party complaint. And then, based on the fact that there was a reasonable basis to bring the third-party complaint and the various procedures that are required by Rule 11 and required by decisions of this court were not followed, and because the third-party complaint was properly brought, I ask the court to reverse the sanctions order in this case, too.
I just had a question.
Yes,
on
ma'am.
MS&P's motion to dismiss. You
yes.
had a couple months to respond to that,
I did,
right?
And I did respond.
And why? You did respond.
Yes, I did.
And why wasn't that adequate time?
Well, Judge, if they had given me the notice, I would have responded to that, too. I suppose I had time, but at the time I was responding, I did not understand that sanctions were at stake, or $200,000 in sanctions were at stake. And I think that if I had, I would have brought forth even more evidence. I think, for instance, as I mentioned in my response to the motion for sanctions, I believe, I point out that during negotiations, of which I was a part, the opposing counsel was a part, we were told the release didn't reach, that the settlement agreement didn't deal with Conoco, and that's consistent with the deposition testimony of opposing counsel. Now, let me just say that with all that we had on our side, I thought that would be enough to beat sanctions, too. I hope I've answered your question, ma'am.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anyway, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Nasha.
Good morning. I want to follow up on a few things he said, and then I would like to go into a couple of the issues that demonstrate why sanctions were appropriate. The first thing that I would suggest is that the reason he doesn't address the definitions in his brief, as we do, starting on page 22 of our reply, is because if you go back through the definitions, there are a number of things in those definitions that are not helpful. And I would point out the example that has not been mentioned by him, but the definition of Sauget Area 1 includes not only sites that are adjacent or contiguous thereto, so as to be an indistinguishable part thereof, or any portion of any property constituting a drainage pathway. And Judge Murphy was quite familiar with the settlement agreement. He reviewed it, and he entered an order approving it. There's no dispute that it was an allegation that the Cahokia facility was a drainage pathway for PCBs that were getting into the creek. That was in the complaint that we argued that was addressed by the United States in their AOC-1. I can go through that with you, but all of that.
AOC-1.
The United States issued an administrative order on consent.
I think if you use words, you would find that more helpful to judges who have not spent years in this litigation.
And, you know, I'm glad you raised that point, because Judge Murphy spent 14 years resolving this litigation. And he knew it backwards.
No wonder he retired.
Yes. He retired because he was getting pestered with me, although he did say, Judge, before he retired, that he wanted to come back as an environmental lawyer because all you needed was one case and you could have your entire career done for you. Mm-hmm. In any event, Judge, it's key in the settlement agreement. There are a number of other things that Mr. Schultz did not address. For example, in the excluded claim section, there's no reference to the Conoco property or the Cahokia site. The agreement also provides that it releases any suit that claims could have been brought, any suit, not only existing claims, but any claims that could have been brought, and as we'll get into in just a little bit, this is where Judge Murphy really went off, because in this case, in the case we filed, Rogers brought a suit, a third-party action against Conoco for our releases from the, basically from the Cahokia facility. They also brought a counterclaim against my client for providing materials that they released on the Cahokia facility. Oh, they at least say in the alternative they released on the Cahokia facility. So the issue here is clearly they've pled themselves into a dilemma in the fact that they could have very well brought my client, essentially sued my client in the 2010 action for the contamination on the Cahokia facility, just as they tried to do with Conoco. The only reason the Conoco claim didn't go forward is, as Judge Murphy points out, they failed to get leave to file it. And they didn't refile it. So that's another issue that I think is important to the settlement agreement. The last thing I want to address with the settlement agreement is molecules or particles or pollutants don't have addresses. And if you read the language of the settlement agreement, once these get out into the environment, there's no fingerprint that you can use. PCBs are PCBs, whether they come from one source or the other. PCBs being polychlorinated biphenyls. Whether they come from one source or the other, you can't determine where they come from.
Why not?
And
that sounds like that's the kind of thing that can be done with isotopic signatures.
The problem with PCBs, and I could get into isotopic signatures, is that once it gets into environment, Judge, it basically degrades very slowly, but it tends to look like all the PCBs in the environment because the lower chlorinated materials come off the molecule first. So everything gravitates to the higher chlorinated materials, which is why it makes fingerprinting them so difficult. In this case, and if you go back and look at the release, and you look at, and Mr. Schultz says that the release doesn't cover the Cahokia facility or the Conoco site. It's really the Cahokia facility. There's a release. Both sides release each other on the basis of any groundwater or other types of remedies, investigative enforcement or oversight costs. And this is paragraph 5, Roman numeral 5. Any investigative monitoring or oversight costs. And this included groundwater. Okay, that's the other thing. You can't really figure out where groundwater comes from if everybody's putting the same pollutant into the groundwater. That's another thing. It was important for Rogers to have finality in this settlement. So the settlement really went to the issue of, since we can't fingerprint it, we're going to release, both sides are going to release each other for these contaminants. And that's why this is important. I'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, it says right there, without regard to whether any such remediation of a contaminant attributable to any such Area 1 sites is conducted off-site or out of Sauget Area 1. And then it gives an example. This is another reason why delving into this release, this was not a release of the parties for the cleanup of the Cahokia facility. We weren't being released by Rogers for, the cleanup of the Cahokia facility itself. We were releasing each other for the pollutants on the Cahokia facility, and that is why this release is worded the way it is. That's why it talks about drainage pathways. And so as far as it goes, Judge Murphy was familiar with this, as you may know from the record. Judge Murphy actually tried the case between between the United States government and Rogers. It was a lengthy trial. Rogers won the case. They didn't even put on a defense. The point being that they won it because, and if you go back and look at the November 3rd, 2003 transcript, the judge goes forward and strikes a bunch of the witnesses because some expert testimony because the government failed to comply with the federal rules. It was a bad day for the United States in doing that. I want to address briefly this issue that the court raised about Judge Murphy. There was no question when we left Judge Murphy's chambers following the oral argument on the motion to dismiss that all of us expected Judge Murphy to issue an order following his receipt of our motion for attorney fees. And there was no question about that. Everyone was surprised when Rogers filed the motion for attorney fees. And even Judge Murphy in his order said, before the court ruled on Solutia's motion for attorney fees and before the court entered any written docket entry, basically the case went up on appeal. I think Judge Murphy did a magnificent job of parsing the settlement agreement in his in the transcript, as you can read, and I think that's pretty important. Let's get to this issue, which I think is an important issue, is the sanction issue.
Well, before you do, I've got trouble with your testimony from the deposition.
All right. I'll be glad to discuss that.
Cook County.
Let me tell you what happened in that case, Your Honor. While we were negotiating the settlement, which is this agreement, and I should say that Judge Murphy found no ambiguity, and so he just basically said this testimony as you started to go inciting the agreement about ambiguity. He says the agreement's not ambiguous. I'm not going to pay much attention to this testimony. But since my name is probably mentioned in the brief more than anybody else's and more than any case, let me address that. We were in settlement negotiations, and the insurance company, Travelers, was trying to stop the negotiations. They were no longer willing to pay anything but a certain amount of money. They then filed a declaratory judgment action in Cook County, even though the site was in St. Clair County, and this site had been litigated in St. Clair County in front of Judge Murphy for years. We then filed suit after we settled. We hadn't yet settled. We filed suit in St. Clair County. The testimony I was given was pursuant to cross motions for forum nonconvenience. We were trying to move the case back into St. Clair, or keep it in St. Clair County, and they were trying to keep it in Cook County. So my answers had to deal with what was our lawsuit didn't include the cleanup of the Conoco site. It didn't include the cleanup. It was a release, but no resolution of the cleanup of the Conoco site between Conoco and whoever Rogers. It didn't resolve that. All these other sites resolved those issues. When we made our claim against Travelers, Your Honor, that claim did not include the cleanup of the Conoco site. So when I'm under oath on a farm nonconvenience, and if you look at it, they didn't give you the entire amount of my testimony, but the portion they did give you, I specifically asked, are you talking about the insurance claim? That portion dealt with whether our action was more appropriate in St. Clair County and had the correct parties, or whether the action in Cook County was more appropriate. And they're asking me, basically, did Conoco need to be joined in the action if you go through some of that testimony? I'm saying to them, from an insurance claim standpoint, since we did not have a settlement agreement that included the cleanup of the Conoco site, that's not what was released, but the cleanup of the Conoco site, there wasn't a claim then against Travelers. Now, once Conoco filed its lawsuit after we had already basically filed ours, once Conoco filed their lawsuit, Travelers had added Conoco to their claim, and they were taking a position in state court before Judge Flynn that their case was basically the best, I would say, the most appropriate case to go forward as opposed to our case, which did not have Conoco in it. And that's why I'm saying to them, we didn't put Conoco in the complaint because they hadn't sued Rogers at the time. Secondly, we hadn't resolved the cleanup of the Conoco site, so therefore we didn't have an action for indemnity for the cleanup of the Conoco site. And that's really what I was suggesting. The interrogatories that I was responding to specifically say that these are interrogatories specific to the motions for forum nonconvenience. This was because of the cross motions being filed. There was discovery by both sides as to what was the most appropriate location for the case. And that's the context within which those were given. And Rogers knew that. The judge knew that. Judge Murphy knew that. That's why he got very irritated with this whole refiling of this claim. And that goes back to why were sanctions appropriate. We've covered them in our brief, but let me talk a little bit about this whole idea that they argue about notice and sua sponte. First of all, if something is on the judge's own decision, in other words, no one has asked the judge to rule on sanctions, then it is sua sponte. Then they come back and argue, well, we didn't. They make the safe harbor argument on the sanctions issue. And let me say this. There's a reason why abuse of discretion is the standard for overturning sanctions. Judge Murphy knew what Rogers was jeopardizing when they filed this claim. First of all, they were jeopardizing a coverage action that Monsanto Solution Pharmacia had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to win, which provided Rogers with money to actually resolve the Cahokia issue. So he knew all about that. He also knew, well, he knew because we put it in our brief, that Rogers, after they sued Monsanto Solution Pharmacia, tried to get us conflicted out of the case because we then, after representing Monsanto Solution Pharmacia for 20 years in Sauge on these very same issues, they were going to try to conflict us out of the case. On top of that, because they filed that lawsuit, Travelers told Rogers they had to conflict us out of the insurance coverage case because we were now adverse to Rogers' interest. And so this created just a series of very difficult issues. We had witnesses. I have to stay on the record. But this created very serious issues because we were going through discovery on Rogers' behalf that Travelers was taking and representing their employees while they basically were arguing we were conflicted out of the case. All this was in our brief, that request for motion for sanctions. Judge Murphy was totally aware of this. He was also aware that the settlement we put together, where Rogers only paid $50,000, even though the amount that we had pursued with them was in the millions of dollars, was a method that we developed in order to keep Rogers in business. And the judge was distraught that after he had spent so much time trying to resolve this issue so Rogers didn't go out of business, that Rogers would then turn around and jeopardize that very settlement. And that's very clearly set out in his transcript. He pointed his fingers at Rogers' counsel, who was in the room, not their outside counsel, their in-house counsel, who's been directly involved in this case over many years, pointed his finger at her and just asked the question, do you realize what you're asking me to do? And this was a non-provoked situation. There was no reason that they had to do this because, in fact, they could have sued us, as the agreement points out. And there are documents I can go over if I have time where they admitted they could have sued us. The Conoco filing is an admission that they could have, whether or not they would have won is inconsequential. The allegation was present and it could have been brought in the initial action. That's where Judge Murphy focused on this. Lawsuits are released, and lawsuits that could have been brought are released as well. That's why this is important. You know they knew, Judge, about the Cahokia facility because it's in the agreement. So they knew they had a liability there at the time they signed the settlement agreement, and they still kept the same language. They made no changes to the language. Getting back to this, and Judge, you asked about the process and whether they had notice. First, they argue sua sponte, that the judge did this on his own motion. That's absolutely wrong. Then they come back and they argue safe harbor, that they were entitled to 21 days notice. Here's what really happened. And I guess when a lawyer tells you here's what really happened, you immediately think he's not telling the truth. But here's what really happened. We filed a motion to dismiss months before the issue of sanctions came up. And in that motion to dismiss, that was to dismiss this claim that they filed against us in the 2010 action, we filed a motion to dismiss. That motion requested attorney fees. That's what the motion did. It requested attorney fees. Rogers' brief says that Judge Murphy inquired was that whether MSP was asking for fees and costs. That's what they say in their brief. That's not what he did. That's not at all what he did. And that's not even an accurate quote of what he did. What Judge Murphy was asking the parties was, he turned to me and he said, Mr. Nassif, are you still asking for fees and costs? That's not sua sponte. There's nothing sua sponte. He's referring back to the motion we had on file that Rogers for attorney fees that laid out in that motion the reasons why we thought we should recover our attorney fees. That's door number one. Now let's talk about this 21 days. They had more than 21 days. It's true. It's true.
Would you agree that Rule 11 is the only basis that would support the attorney's fee award?
Yes, Your Honor, and I know 1927 is where you're talking about fees put on the attorney, but I think Rule 11, specifically B1 and B3, are appropriate in this case. They cite B2. We're not talking about that. But the judge cited Rule 11, and I do agree it's appropriate. It is the area. I don't want to walk away from the common law justification for sanctions when an attorney files something in bad faith or a company files something. But really, it's Rule 11, and that's what we're talking about. When Rogers filed the complaint, and it's in our motion for fees and costs, there were a series of emails that went back and forth. The first email was an email indicating to them that we were upset. The second email is an email that was dated May 30th, before we filed our motion to dismiss, specifically asked for us to have a meeting with Mr. We sent it to Mr. Schultz and said, we'd like to have a meeting with you. We want to talk about the filing of this complaint and the implications of it. He refused to meet with us. And so we made efforts, at least. And I know that if you read some of the cases, it's pretty clear that if you made an effort to come into substantial compliance on the notice issue, or at least to try and give them notice and walk them through that, that's good enough. That's good enough. And this was way before the judge even considered the issue of sanctions. I think that's a pretty good indicator. That's a pretty good indicator that they had plenty of time. The other thing they argue in their brief is that they never had a hearing. They never requested a hearing. They had a right to file their response to our motion. And if you read the transcript carefully, when Judge Murphy hinted that he was going to consider seriously our motion for fees and expenses in the transcript, I asked for time. I didn't say, yes, we'll file it. He asked me if I was still asking for it, and I said, Judge, give me a few days to get back to you. And he said, Mr. Nassif, we need to get this behind us. That's all you're going to have. They had an opportunity, after they heard what he was going to do, to step up and say, we'll drop this matter. We won't pursue it. We won't go on appeal. You drop your request for attorney fees, and we'll drop. Nothing. Nothing. Clear indication from the judge that he was upset, that he thought they had violated a very unambiguous agreement, and that they were basically filing a frivolous lawsuit for all the reasons he sets out in the transcript, for which he did not have a chance to write an order. So this whole idea or this notion that they were entitled to a more official notice or more of an opportunity is for lack of a better term, bogus. They had an opportunity, had multiple opportunities to head this issue off, and they decided not to do it. So why was he so upset about the filing? As I said to the court, we were pursuing them, and it says it in our complaint, filed on January 22nd, requires Pharmacia to conduct, the government's order to us requires us to conduct an ECA, environmental assessment, and so it's, I'll quit using the acronyms, and possibly, and impacted portions of SA1, and any possibly contaminated residential commercial properties adjacent to these creek segments. That's what we were suing them for. residential and commercial properties adjacent to the creek settlements. Now, we can argue all day what adjacent means, but the fact of the matter is, when we allege that the Cahokia facility is a drainage pathway of contamination into the creek, Creek Sector F, that's certainly sufficient to put them on notice that we're suing for the Cahokia facility and gives them the opportunity to understand what they're releasing. That's number one. Rogers comes back with a counterclaim, pleading in the alternative, on information and belief, Pharmacia and Solution, this is their counterclaim, each arranged for the transport and disposal of hazardous substances by Rogers Cartage Trucking Company without informing them of the contents, risk, and substances involved, and some of these hazardous substances may have found their way into Area 1 and Dead Creek. So, again, we have a release agreement that includes a release agreement of a claim that we made against them. It goes beyond Area 1, and a counterclaim that's not limited. It just says may have found their way into Sauget Area 1, SA1. I went and took a look at Rogers' memorandum in opposition to our motions for fees and costs. And they have an explanation in there as to why they sued Conoco in the action we brought against them. It's on page 2, and it says, at one point, Rogers Cartage sought to bring in Conoco as a third-party defendant on the basis that if Rogers Cartage's activities at the Cahokia property, they're talking about bringing why they brought Conoco or tried to bring Conoco in, at the Cahokia property outside of Sauget Area 1 could be the basis for a claim in the lawsuit, so too would Conoco be liable for its activities at its Cahokia property outside of SA1 for the contamination of the SA1 subject of the lawsuit. They could have put our name on this. They could have said the exact same thing because they cleaned, according to them, cleaned our trucks on the Cahokia facility, and we were no more innocent than Conoco. Judge Murphy pointed this out. He said, you brought a lawsuit against Conoco, and the only reason that third party...
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon me?
Thank you, counsel.
I'm done. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Schultz?
Yes, sir.
First, just a couple points with regard to my opponent's own words in deposition. Quote, our settlement does not deal with the existing Conoco property. This is put forth several times in my brief. These are his sworn testimony. The Cahokia, Rogers Cahokia facility was not part of Area 1 or Area 2. It was not included in the settlement agreement. No, there was no reason for it because it was not included in our settlement agreement. So his own words are in accordance with my argument here today and provided a basis for our third-party complaint. Number two, before the court, he argued that the Cahokia facility was a drainage pathway. That's disputed. We disputed that in the 2003 trial. We disputed that when we answered their complaint. And when we filed our third-party complaint, we made it in the alternative, and we stated that we're bringing this in the alternative, and it's only this third-party claim is only comes into effect if we're liable to them. The decisions of this court and other courts are if you plead in the alternative, that is not an admission that allows someone to get summary judgment against you, which is what really this issue should have been decided on summary judgment since, one, there are disputed issues of fact. Number two, when we brought our third-party complaint, we said this is brought in the alternative. We're not admitting that Cahokia pollutants are getting to Dead Creek, but if they are, if it's found that and we're liable because of that, then we bring this third-party complaint. When you bring a third-party complaint, according to the analysis of Monsanto Solution Pharmacia, you would be admitting the primary complaint's allegations against you, and that's not how it works. So whether the Cahokia facility is a drainage pathway is a disputed issue of fact. Number two, there is no dispute that opposing counsel has testified that the Cahokia facility was not part of the settlement agreement. The reference to excluded claims in the settlement agreement only applied to Area 1 and Area 2 claims. In other words, not even all the Area 1 and Area 2 claims are released. Personal injury claims, natural resources, damages actions are not released. The 1999 lawsuit was an Area 1 case only. There was never a claim in the 1999 lawsuit for cleaning up the Cahokia property, the Conoco property, the Phillips property. It was only for cleaning up Area 1. Now, if they had wanted to release the Cahokia site, all they had to do was put that in the releases. You look at the whereas clauses in the settlement agreement, it talks about Area 1 and Area 2. You look at the releases themselves, they talk about Area 1.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, everyone.
Case is taken under advisement.